It is our privilege today to have a very distinguished guest on our campus, Ms. Lisa Sergio. Ms. Sergio is a specialist and lecturer in world affairs. She will be on our campus both today and tomorrow. She will be speaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock here in this auditorium and this evening at 8:30. You're welcome to attend and to bring guests with you to attend these lectures. Ms. Sergio is a pioneer in mass communications and pioneer in women's radio broadcasting. She has traveled the world around and is very informed concerning world conditions. Ms. Sergio, I would like to say that we welcome you to Bluefield College. We hope you enjoy your visit as much as we enjoy having you with us, and we shall hear you at this time. Ms. Sergio.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I heard from Miss Johnson, who kindly fetched me at the airport, that right under here are your music rooms. It is not because of that that I might provide myself with accompaniment, that is, coughing, but they might consider down here that I was trying to be an orchestra all by myself. It's just that I was in Ohio addressing a teachers' convention two or three days ago, and it snowed terrifically, and I was caught in a blizzard, and now I come here and you give me summertime, so I just can't adjust. Maybe I should go to a psychiatrist. I'm glad to be with you because you are the future of the country, and therefore you are the most interesting part of the population, but also I am particularly interested in sharing with you something about our role with what we commonly refer to as the non-committed nations. And this chiefly because the non-committed nations will have assumed a much more definite personality and really a much more powerful or effective role in world affairs at the time that you will be a full-fledged citizen, that is, out of your school years, no doubt, and playing a more effective role than you can possibly hope to do now in the nation's life. You know probably that just a few months ago the United Nations completed a census of the world population and came out with a figure that is commonly believed to be quite accurate, because it is possible now to count people in the jungles, in high mountain areas. There are means of transportation now which didn't exist even 5 or 6 years ago, so that when they come out with their figures for a world census, they're likely to be accurate. There are 3 billion and close to 300 million people who populate the earth at this time. Of these, 1 billion and about 100 million constitute what we call the non-committed people of the world. They are an extremely important group because they are people, and because there are so many of them, obviously, but chiefly because of the division of the rest of the population of the world. Of the remaining part, only about 800 million constitute what we would call the free societies. They are largely in the West, and among these, we are the leader, both for size and obviously for power. The third group is the largest of the three, and consists of 1 billion and more than 200 million people, and this is the communist group. You might say that because this group includes Red China with its 760 million people, and Red China and the Soviet Union are not having a love affair precisely at the moment, you might say that this does not constitute as threatening a group as it might be. Well, I think the important fact to remember particularly for people of your generation. Today, yes, we could exploit this division between Moscow and Peking. By the time you are facing the world, not only the consequences of its shape and of its various political divisions, but of what will have happened by that time, I think that communist unity will have been restored. The whole question is that the division today between Moscow and Peking is not one of ideology. They agree, basically, on Marxist concepts and also on the idea that the world as a whole is destined to become a communist world. I'm sorry. Maybe this is a communist gremlin that doesn't like me to say these things. They are divided now as to how you carry out and you fulfill your communist mandate. Either by violence, as you are now seeing it done in Peking, or by moving more and more towards the more liberal aspects of life, as you see in Moscow. This is a division as to method. It is not a division that goes deeply into the concept of ideology. I think you could look at the free society and you can see a tremendous division of opinion between ourselves and France. Anyway, this is a very good place in which to drop dead. And I hope you all sing in the choir. Because if I'm going to do it, it's got to be in style. There is a division between ourselves and France. It's a division, again, of method. They believe that you do not protect the free world by keeping nuclear weapons, more or less, those which are in the free world, all in one place, and with only one person, the President of the United States, having the right to decide if and when to use these weapons. They believe that this is not the way in which you protect freedom, because it is, and rightly so, is the statement made, a surrender of freedom. They feel that they should have nuclear weapons, that since Britain already has them, Germany is likely to, and that by agreement these weapons should be used, but not just by the decision of one power. This is a very profound difference. But the difference relates to the protection of a free way of life. That's the issue. On that free way of life, they are not divided. If tomorrow there were to be a threat against the free societies of the world, from China or the Soviet Union or whatever power could threaten them, this apparent breach between ourselves and France would be healed in no time flat. If this is true of us, it is likewise true in the communist world. Consequently, when you are thinking in terms of the non-committed nations, I think you still have to look at this enormous communist bloc for what it is, the largest bloc of humanity that ever in the history of mankind has been gathered under the umbrella of a common ideology. Therefore, the non-committed people are the most important. Because while they are not a majority, nor even a minority in the bloc, upon their decision as to which pattern of life they will choose rests the development of a majority of thought. For the moment, there is no majority. Because even though there are more people in the communist sphere, even than in the non-committed sphere, and certainly than in the free one, it is not a majority in the sense, as our election of yesterday has made us very much aware, of one above the half. Therefore, the non-committed people of the world and the turn they take is going to be the decisive element as to whether when you are out making a life for yourselves, looking ahead into the future, whether you are going to continue to lead a life that is constantly under the cloud that those who are today perhaps 30 or that those who alas are in Vietnam have known. Always this sense, oh yes, we are doing fine, we are very prosperous, we are very affluent, we have the highest standard of living, everything is fine, we are even going to probably have a party on the moon one of these days. Interesting. But still there is no peace. Always this threat. The committed countries consist all, the non-committed countries consist all of them of people who are not white. They are either black in Africa or brown as in India or yellow as in parts of Africa or of a sort of mixture of races called usually Indians who inhabit Latin America. All of these peoples at some time in their history have known the rule of the white man. They have been part of a colonial world. So they don't love the British or the French or the Germans who also ruled over them, or the Portuguese who still do, or the Italians who once did, or the Spaniards. Although, interestingly enough, everything that they are today, everything that Nigeria or Guinea or the people of Vietnam or Indonesia or any part of the world that you can think of, or the Latin Americans, everything that they're striving for, everything that is causing a confusion, even every method they use, is all taken from the Western white people and has not been taken from us because we were never in their midst. It's not even been taken from the Russians, who were never in their midst. It's been taken from the white colonial powers. And this is what has happened, that all of these countries, with very few exceptions, Angola is one of them, sit in the United Nations as independent countries, Nigeria, Rwanda, Tanzania, Guinea, and on, you can name all of them, not only in Africa, but in other parts of the world, and when there is a vote cast, the vote counts for one, whether it is cast by one of these very small, very new, very insecure countries, or whether it is cast by something as powerful as ourselves, or even the Soviet Union. The difference, of course, of which the leaders of these small countries or of these new countries are well aware, is that behind a vote cast lie a lot of other things. Supposing that you represented Guinea and you cast a vote to go to the defense of the Viet Cong, which, if they were casting a vote, I suppose is the way they would think, for they are moving very swiftly towards the communist end of the spectrum. All right, so they approve of the communists. They want to aid the Viet Cong. This would not disturb us or anybody else, because how could they, from where they are in Africa, a small country, very underdeveloped, with no army that has ever been trained to fight a war in the jungle or anywhere else, what would it mean? They can't send any help to the Viet Cong. Now, if the Soviet Union decides that it's really going to send some help to the Viet Cong, then you've got something. Because if the Soviet Union really wanted to do so, it could send as much as we. If now, maybe the quality wouldn't be as good, but they could send as much. Consequently, what good does it do you to vote one if you can't back it up? The eagerness of these people is to back it up. And when you are thinking in terms of backing up your political power, You think in terms, yes, of a certain amount of military power, but these people are tired of fighting, and they know very little about modern fighting. They want to back it up with those things that the white man in their midst has always had, and which they have never had. For example, the life expectancy in this country is somewhere between officially 65 and 70. Now, if you happen to be a voter in Vermont, as I am, you don't bow out until you're 90. That's why you shouldn't worry about that cough, because I'm not quite 90 yet. Coming to it, but not quite. The life expectancy in the Soviet Union is between 65 and 70. In India, one of the non-committed, underdeveloped countries, and the second country for population, 460 million people, the life expectancy of women, even now, in India, is somewhere about 24 to 25 years of age. If you girls were Indians, all of you sitting here or not living in this country, you would probably not have the 100 years that I'm sure you're all expecting to live. It would be just a little exaggerated. The life expectancy of men is somewhere around 30 years. The same is true of Africa. Now, if you have so little time, and remember that the leaders in these countries, the people who today are in government, are people who have already passed this age limit, or are approaching it. And the reason for which their life expectancy is short is that they have in their background poor nutrition, if not altogether malnutrition, appalling housing conditions, infections and disease carried by insects against which they have in the past had no provision. They know very well that the white man can live. Now, whether he's communist or whether he is free, the white man can live to be 70. And they're in a desperate hurry to achieve those things that will improve their health and preserve their life. Because if you don't happen to be alive, even the discussion of freedom, I suppose, is interesting. But I don't believe that you can really use it wherever it is you may go. Whether you go to your own particular heaven, or to the heaven of the animist, or with Allah, or wherever your religion takes you. Political freedom, we hope, is not going to be necessary up there. We're not going to be bedeviled by elections, I hope. So that, and even a high standard of living, excellent education, what good is it if you're not alive? And you see, with us, we have been so long accustomed to taking it as a natural matter, of course, that a person who dies before 65 has died young. And a person who really dies very young, it's a tragedy. Except, I might point out to you, that your generation has no regard for life. Because if you really did have a feeling that life is gone in a flick, sure, men are tough, men can stand terrible hardship. Humanity is built to withstand fantastic things. But in a speeding car, in 1 second, the thread is broken. And there are more deaths under 20 years of age in car accidents than over, and many more than among people who are 40 or 50. We are losing young people at a frightening rate. And if we are not losing them altogether because they are killed, we are losing them because they become appallingly crippled. This is a terrible disregard for life. And if you think that the report of our car accident is not swinging the young people of your generation who are in all of these non-committed countries towards communism, you are mistaken. I have heard them myself say, Americans? They don't care about life. They have no sense of discipline, even when it is a matter of the engine they control. They pass the red light. They drive on the wrong side of the road. They don't obey the rules. Mind you, 90% of accidents are due to non-obedience of traffic rules, whether on the part of the person who hit or who was hit, the person who dies or the person who survives. I have heard this comment. And they cannot say that this happens in the Russian communist society, advanced as it is over the Chinese, because they don't have that number of cars. And also, because they are highly disciplined people and wouldn't have those accidents. Of course, a certain number of accidents always happen. They happen in the home when you're not handling any machine. But this fantastic rate that has caused the insurance rates to skyrocket in this country, even among people who've never had an accident, is a reflection on your disregard of the importance of life. I'm saying this to you because when this young man, who is destined to be one of the great leaders in Africa, he's taking a graduate degree in this country, made this point to me, said, oh, I've been interested in American ideas and methods, but the thing that kills America as a possible example to us, even in education, is that there is no discipline. And because they have no discipline, they are not capable of giving themselves self-discipline. They even end up by killing themselves. Why should we, who have never had long lives, we who are so passionately eager to live long enough to enjoy this freedom which we have finally achieved, why should we accept an ideology that makes so light of life? I have had arguments to combat this, but they come from an older person, and while they might be perhaps wiser, they can be broken down with the example of the not caring about any of the rules that govern a society, which are so evident in the younger generation. I'm saying this to you not because I intend to or would be equipped to deliver a sermon. No. Because when I was your age, and you'll be mine someday, so don't give yourself airs. When I was your age, the men of my generation, well, I might have been 14 or 15, and the boys might have been 18 or 19, but it was the same generation. Those young men were so disturbed by the social problems of Europe. This goes back to the 20s. That when a dictator came along and said to the young, look, you've been looting. There was plenty of looting. There was communism rising. There was total disobedience of the law. He appealed to the educated class from which I came, which was the upper class, similar to the upper class in all of the non-committed countries. Here in this country, the majority of people, all people go to school, the majority of people go to college. It's very hard to talk about, I am appealing to the upper class of the American educated intellect. It's no longer possible to make this appeal even in Europe today and know that you're hitting the only people who are going to be at the top. But you know that anybody you speak to who is in a college or a university today in the non-committed countries has to be a leader, because they are a handful of people, for the simple reason that nobody was ever educated in the lower schools except a handful of people, and mostly in a missionary school. So everybody who is at the top today knows he has to be a leader. It was the same in Italy, in most of Europe, in those days. And he appealed to us and said, look, I will give you a reason for restoring law and order. Your country needs you. I will show you how to get back to the sound virtues, how to distribute things evenly and properly, how to. And the younger generation followed him, because there comes a time when if you, having finished your college education or finished whatever education you're going to take beyond this, you begin to face a career, and the woman you marry cannot go out in the street alone after dark because she's threatened by rape and murder, which is common with my generation and the younger women of my time. There isn't a city in the United States where you can go out alone at night, not only women, but men. Look at the rate of crime and muggings and attacks. It doesn't happen anywhere else. If you saw this, believe me, you would try to do something to get for yourself a strong government if there were somebody appealing to you on that basis. And you would be so keen for this strength that you wouldn't realize that you had lost your freedom. I stand here before you as one who even worked for a dictator, for Mussolini. I was the first woman broadcaster in Europe because Mussolini was a man of great brains and great mind, invented the idea of broadcasting in foreign languages, and I was invited to be the first one. It's an accident of fate. But I knew him well. After he had grabbed that entire generation, after Hitler did the same thing with the young people, the people between 18 and 22, 17 and 22, this was the backbone of fascism. The backbone of Hitler, with a few top wise men at the top, so-called wise, to guide the whole thing. This is the backbone of communism. Every rising generation is profoundly attached to it. You ought to be the generation that understands what the values of this country are. But if you play so, I don't know how to describe it even, so glibly, I would say glibly if they were words, with your life, you can't attach any meaning to it. And if you want to go out in a car and kill yourself, I suppose it really is a question between you and your maker when you meet him. But what you are doing is ruining the future for the people of your own generation who are going to be alive, because communism will have taken hold right on this kind of issue. Of the 1,200,000,000 people in these underdeveloped countries, this desire to grow, which they have, economically, educationally, health-wise, is of course taken from what the white man has done. They see us having developed a fabulous society. They see the Soviet Union having done not so badly either, despite what we would think was a rather difficult way of life. And this is what they have to imitate and adopt. So true is it that all of our programs in these countries are directed to showing them how to do the very same things that we do. Consequently, they look at us. And what is it that discourages them? What is it that has made Guinea throw out all the members of the Peace Corps that have been working there teaching them? They were thrown out yesterday. Nothing against those individuals. But they represent an ideology with which those people will have no contact. Why in Vietnam do you find the people of so-called the Viet Cong, they're the same people, they're just across the line. It would be as if there were some people in Virginia and in West Virginia, so you're all the same, and that suddenly some were beginning to betray the others. Why are they not all attached to freedom? Why has there been so little support for us there? Because they look at our society and they wonder whether we are really sincere. It's a harsh word to say, but I am concerned. I happen to escape from my own country through the providence of God, because many of the people of my generation died. And I don't want to see this country disappear. And it's going to lose out, or I'm not going to say wiped out, a bomb could wipe out everybody, but we mustn't think of that possibility, I hope. But I mean lose its power, lose its appeal. We've lost much of it in the last 3 or 4 years. I don't want to see this happen, and it will happen, if the majority of the non-committed people, in finally developing programs that lengthen their life, that improve their education, that develop their economy, as they are doing, largely with help from us, decide that nonetheless, the ideology for which we speak is one they would reject, because it does not seem able to teach people to appreciate and protect what they've got. Let me point out one thing to you. There is more talk in this country about private enterprise and capitalism and private ownership than of almost any other angle of our free society. One reason for which so many people dislike communism is that they don't have private ownership. To me, I don't give a two hoots whether they have private ownership. My reason for not wanting them to dominate the world is in the realm of the spirit and of the mind. But we emphasize private ownership. Do you know that the rate of vandalism of property, done by children, mind you, has so increased in the last 4 or 5 years that insurance rates on property have gone up for that reason? How can you talk of private property and enterprise when no child is raised to respect that of his neighbors? His neighbors don't respect his either. Consequently, all of it is threatened. This is what creates the impression. It's not whether the President of the United States happens to make a tour. This isn't going to have any influence on the people of India, to mention the largest of these groups. It is the image of the life of the nation, because whether you live in the jungle and are illiterate and worship God in a tree or believe in the medicine man, or whether you are a highly civilized, highly developed person going to one of our great colleges and having everything that we need, and perhaps even being a Christian who believes that God is not dead, there are very few of them, but a few still around, whichever of these two extremes you may be, the fact remains that the society, the family, are continued by exactly the same method. Men are still born of women. None have been born otherwise that I know of, not even in China yet. They are still the result of man and woman coming together in a union, which is not only physiological, but has to be a union of love, of social understanding, a bond that will protect the new creature, make the new creature feel that he is protected by someone. This is the essence of the family. This is still true in the jungle and ought to be still true in our society. The jungle family that wants to evaluate its freedom, the tribes which are still fighting in some of these countries, they haven't learned things about tribal war, but they do know that the white man has been able to take his society, keep the children alive, do away with the terrible diseases by which entire villages were wiped out. It's the growth of the family that they are concerned, because you cannot give weight to your vote in the United Nations with a strong army, a strong economy, an enlightened educational pattern if you don't have people. People have to be alive, and people are the result of family. And they look at you and me, not at whether we get to the moon, not at whether we have the world's best nuclear weapons, not whether we have more cars, but they look at how people who live in a civilized society, with a free society, which is what we talk about, how they provide the family with all the things they've never had: security, health, happiness, not the material things they don't know about. And they see in us an image of anger, of rebellion. They see in us, lastly, who talk about being Christians, the denial of everything they have learned. Remember that your generation has an opportunity that no generation has had before you and no generation will have after you, which is what I said before, that every young man and woman who is today in a college or in a university in any of these countries, and there are colleges and universities of very high degree in these countries. We've helped to set some of them up. Some of them are very ancient, as in India. They go back 5,000 years. But very few people can attend them because there were no schools, no public schools. So I repeat to you that every one of those who is your age today, but over there, knows that he must take everything he can out of that education, because the survival of his country, the preservation of the freedom they have won, depends on the kind of leadership he is going to give it. And every man and woman who is in those colleges has had education from elementary grades, 90% of them in missionary schools. This will never happen again, because in all of these countries there is already today the making of a public school, secular public school system, which is growing rapidly. So that as every year that passes, you will have a growing number of students coming up through the grades normally as we do, and coming up finally in 9 years, because they have the European system, it takes 9 years, not 12, to get to college level, they will come into college in very great numbers. So that any generation that is in universities that will match the generations that succeed you in those seats will not have the opportunity of being looked at a distance, but in the reflection of everything you do, by people who are the public opinion makers of their country, who are going to direct their country when they get to power in a few years, either for us or against us. And they are people who know what Christianity means, because even though they may not have accepted it, they know what it dictates. And when I have traveled through non-Christian countries, where the leaders were young people exactly as I have described to you, who knew about Christianity, if I have had to answer this question once, I've had to answer it a million times. Oh, if you're all Christians over there, so you think it's what Jesus Christ suggested, that because his father made some people with a black skin, you would exclude them from receiving communion? Is this what you mean by Christianity? And if you think that this picture has not reached the whole world, you're mistaken. On this, they will either accept our pattern, or not identically, nobody's pattern can be copied identically, but as a general basic ideology, the concept of our freedom and of our belief in God, which makes our freedom possible. Or they will reject it because they will see that we, by our actions, have rejected it. That we do not value life because we throw it away. That we do not value the mind because we refuse to discipline it. They know that nobody at any level, from the motion picture artist to Einstein, has ever achieved anything without discipline. I can think of nothing more disciplined than the life of a movie actor, who, if he has to be on location at 5 in the morning because the light is right, he's there at 5 in the morning. If he's told to lose 40 pounds weight, he loses them. If he's told, like Elizabeth Taylor, and she must have hated it, to put on 50 pounds and look like a hag, she did it. You may or may not approve of this profession, but if a person has accepted something, there is nothing you can achieve, whether it's the movies or science, and everything in between, without discipline. And they see that we have rejected this. They know that we don't have enough scientists, because when they come to our schools to study science from Africa and Asia, we keep them here, because not enough of our American young men want to go into science or into medicine. And they know, lastly, that because we have not yet accepted the dictate of God that he created all men equal, and that some of our brothers whom God created with different skins from others are not yet enjoying this equality after 100 years. This makes them think that we are not even Christians. They wish they could think otherwise, because their instinct, and I know enough of them to say this, is to lean towards us rather than toward the communists, who in their midst can only be represented by Russia, which they don't know, or by China, whose violence, thank goodness, they have come to dislike. And I know that it would only take a relative handful of people of your generation, it was a handful of people of mine who made the March on Rome and changed the face of the world. A handful of people made Hitler. A handful of people can make freedom the indestructible force that it is, and you could be that handful of people. Thank you.